The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Some content in this video is not covered under our Creative Commons license. See the closing credits for more information.
This lecture is about story and games and the boondoggle that story tends to be, especially when we start talking about story. When we start talking about story and games in particular, we're often borrowing a lot of terms about story from other disciplines, from film, from literature, from comics, all of which can be applied to games, but all of which don't always help in games and can sometimes detract. This lecture is actually originally usually given by, she was a postdoc for a while with us. She taught writing and games, Clara Fernandez-Vera. So I'm basically adapting her lecture. One nice thing about I like about this is that it's very design focused. So, and it actually, there's some problematic language in it and about what is story, what is storytelling, that if you are a studier of that, you might go, ha-ha, no, you're wrong, it's actually blah, but I don't care. This is thinking of it as a, from design perspective, from what actually helps me make the game I want to make, what helps the player, when they're playing the game I'm making, understand how the game works, how to play the game, what kinds of things that I want the player to do. So that's a big caveat. So, and it's also very interactive, so please answer questions if I ask you questions. Also, feel free to break in and just say, ha-ha, no, you're wrong. That's okay. I want to hear. Especially y'all. Let me know when I'm wrong. So first up, do games tell stories? Sometimes?
Yeah. Some games do, some games don't. Some games tell really cool stories, some games tell really nice stories.
Yep.
It's a spectrum.
Yay! Spectrum. Oh, it's entirely a spectrum. So, what's the story of Final Fantasy 13? God help me, I don't know. But when we start talking about stories, oftentimes, especially with people new to games or new to thinking about the design of games, they're thinking about, well, what's the story? Like, I love the stories in the Final Fantasy games. Or, I love the stories of the Metal Gear Solid games, and I love sitting through two-hour cutscenes so I can play the 15 minutes of gameplay in between each. I actually do like that, but that's not what we're talking about in this case. Especially because of the problems with AAA, to tell us stories in those games requires a lot of expensive resources. You need artists, sound designers, writers, and actors, specialized software. There's a huge, unwieldy amount of assets, and the result's actually often a film plus a game, especially Metal Gear Solid. When Metal Gear Solid 3 came with the film version of Metal Gear Solid 3, you don't need the limited edition. You don't need to actually play the game. You can just watch all the cutscenes in the proper sequence. So that's not what we're, like, that's great, that's good, you should know some of that stuff. A lot of the techniques that are used in those kind of things are being borrowed directly from film. Even quick time events are basically films with button presses, that's about it. So let's not think about that for now, let's think about some other stuff. What's the story of Tetris? What's that? Yes, you can film your own story.
And you can not film your own story.
Yes, you can do that too. So what happens when we're playing games, and actually what happens, the way we process pretty much everything, at least some people say, and one way of modeling how we understand the world around us, is we historicize our experiences. There's a linear series of events of my experience of something, and if I string those together and I have a result at the end, that's the story of whatever I just did. So for designer in this first link here, Anna Anthropy, she thinks of the system of mechanics in a game is it's a design experience. And for her, that's the storytelling. That's the story that she's giving, is she's giving the player an experience. And in Tetris' case, the fact that pieces fall, that some pieces are eliminated when you put them in the right place, and that the game is over when there are no more room for pieces, those three very specific small rules to Tetris are the story of the game. But without any additional work, once you play the game, a story can be brought into being. And here's a quote from this edge feature here about the long block of Tetris. And they say, Tetris imitates life. You build an even supported structure out of the raw materials of daily existence and react to the challenges that befall it. You clear away the detritus to begin anew. Nothing in life is certain, but your hope is at some point that missing piece, that lover, that raise, that child, that job, will appear and fall into place, and eventually you die. That's the part they don't put in the article, but it's, you do die. It gets harder, and you die. Is that the story of the life that you really want? I don't know. But yeah, purely with blocks that are controlled by arrow keys, or in the original version, keyboard keys, that could be the story of Tetris.
One of the brilliant things about Tetris is that it's got a progression to it, right? It's not the same thing every instant, because you play at the top of the board or the bottom of the board. The bottom of the board, you're feeling comfortable, you're feeling cool, you take some risks. The top of the board, you're like, oh my god. And so the game feels different. Mm-hmm. No story at all.
And that's what Anna Ashby's talking about. If you go back to Seth Civic's talk about those interest curves, that's the story the game is telling you, and it's expressed in the player's interest in things, in discovering new things, and then mastering them, and then discovering another thing again, and then mastering that. So that kind of curve, you don't have sort of that narrative arc, you have these curves of and this flow of experience. So games don't technically tell stories, as we'll get into in a little bit. And again, we storicize our experiences. Because if we say games tell stories, who's telling the story of the game? If you're playing, like in some games, there might be a narrator, like in Bastion, narrators are very large. Outside, I think. The narrator is a very large element of the game, and it actually reacts to how you play the game by giving you new different types of things, new different pieces of story to fill in. But for our purposes, we're not going to call that storytelling. We're going to call it story building. That the game gives the player building blocks to reconstruct their own story around the experience that they have while they're playing the game. So just putting on a column, storytelling versus story building, and this is where someone who studies this might be say, ha ha, you're wrong. Shut up, I don't care. Storytelling can be considered continuous. It's a one-way communication from God, designer, to reader, player. There's an order of events and disclosure of information determined by the author. Where story building, it's fragmented. There's some collaboration between the designer and the player. The player, in many cases, it's as simple as the player can interact with this thing first and then this thing, or that thing first and then that other thing. But when I talk about story building, it's different than pure world building. World building is a part of story building. And if you've taken Juno Diaz's class on seminar on world building, it's awesome. I highly recommend it. World building is something that story building kind of builds upon. So Minecraft is an excellent game with really great world building. As early as the alpha mode, it had a sword. There was the survival mode. There was crafting. And it had a bit of a story to it. It had the story of your survival. You're thrown into the world with raw materials that you learn how to take the materials and turn them into useful tools. You fight the monsters, and then after you're done fighting the monsters, what's next? There really isn't much, at least in those early versions, and as early back as I played it, which is about a year ago. There really wasn't much more than that. I know now they have villages, and they have the ability to kind of, for someone else to come in and form stories. And that's a different kind of storytelling, it's a different kind of gaming storytelling that we're not really going to touch on this one, in this lecture. This lecture is very much about what we're going to call narrative design. The intentional creation of story by the designer such that the player understands what the designer is getting at. So we're going to make a distinction. Game with story versus story-driven games.
The heroes finally meet under the star of destiny.
Anybody play Soul Calibur 2?
But I can't back.
Yeah.
What do you want?
Battle 1. Fight!
So that's game with story. The story isn't part of the game. You don't need to know anything that's going on in the background. It's two people fighting each other with big swords and ridiculous clothing. But there's a backstory going on behind it. Like oh gods, please forgive me. Why? That's weird. You're fighting, and then you're like, well, I just killed this other person, but please forgive me. What does she need forgiveness about? And the game doesn't really tell you that. Through diving into the backstory behind the game, you might find, and it requires a lot of effort outside of the game to find this out, that Sophitia here, and I might be getting this wrong, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe she's got a sister, and that might have been her sister. There might have been another sister. That was her sister?
Yeah.
Yeah, and she killed her sister. I mean, oh my god. She killed her sister over this sword. But who cares? You're playing this just to fight.
Evil sword.
Evil swords. So what we're talking about instead are story-driven games. There's an attempt part of the game maker to create this narrative experience, and advancing the game means you're advancing in the story itself. The AAA examples for this that we're using here are like Grand Theft Auto 4, Dragon Age Origins. These are story-driven game experiences where the story's out there in the world for you to discover. You pick it up through bits and drabs and pieces. And unfortunately, in these two experiences, you're doing that through cutscenes. But there's also, you know, Zork. You are solving puzzles within this world, and as you solve puzzles within the world, you're learning more and more about the backstory of the game. And in all three of those cases, it's you. You, the player, are doing this. And actually, what I like about this is, in Zork, you are standing in an open field west of the White House. It's very much about it's in that second person, the player is doing all of this. In Dragon Age Origins, you get to create your player, you get to create your character, and what you create is very much a large part of the game itself. It's an extension of you. In Grand Theft Auto, not so much. So there's a little bit of a spectrum going on there. But what I'm hanging onto this, though, on these kind of games, though, is that you, the player, are doing this thing within this world. But we don't need expensive cutscenes to tell stories. Some of these games, what they do, like Zork does not, but the two prior games, you get a little bit of gameplay, and then you get this cutscene experience that kind of explains what the gameplay is. We don't need that. And if you said Half-Life 2 had no cutscenes, you were wrong. Half-Life 2 has lots of cutscenes. They're just inexpensive cutscenes using the game engine. But you've cut out player's agency. Player is now, in this case, looking at this dialogue that's happened between these two characters. The player has no way of doing anything within this other than just waiting for it to end, and it happens many, many times. You stop the game, in this case, to tell me about something, that you're no longer playing the game, you're just listening and watching and being passive. And that's okay. This is totally acceptable within games, but then you're not using games to tell the story. You're just going right back to those filmic experiences, using the narrative arc structure. You're not using the game to tell that story. So in narrative design, what I'm saying is narrative design is the use of the game to tell, to help the player build a story. And you're telling and you're building two stories, the story of the world, and you're discovering these stories, the story of the world and the story of the player. So the story of the world, these are all the events that happened in the fictional world before the game starts. And you're often discovering these story elements through gameplay. Myst is a great example. Has anybody played Myst? Okay. So in Myst, you are basically put in this world. You don't have any explanation of what's going on, and you're slowly playing these puzzles, and through the puzzles themselves, figuring out what the backstory of the world is. The story's a puzzle, but one thing to note is you don't actually need to provide all the pieces to the puzzle for the player to really pick up on that story. By putting in gaps in the right places, the player is going to build that on their own without any effort on the designer's part. There's also the story of the player. And this can be that embedded story that's pre-established by the game. Heavy Rain and a lot of the games that have come out of that Heavy Rain experience where you are, what's his name?
You're four different people.
You're four different people?
Yeah.
Have you been, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I've only played the first little bit. I just remember the Jason part of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, when you play as Ethan?
Ethan, yeah. So when you start off, Ethan has a backstory. There are elements within the backstory that you get to play. There are elements within the story that you play, yeah. You know, going to find his son. But it's entirely, these are pre-established things that the game gives you that then you just kind of figure out. There's also this the emergent story of the game, which isn't necessarily dictated by the game, but it's the result with the player interacting with the system. This is a bit of a special case, and this is a powerful place to live in for video games. The fact that you can create a system in which it reacts to the player in various ways and gives them the story of the game that they're playing is the story of what the player actually does. And that's when we're going back to the Minecraft and going to the Sims. But many like modern AAA games are using multiple elements from these two things. The line of games since Thief and System Shock, the Looking Glass and Origin games that came out of Boston. The games that have kind of come after that, such as Deus Ex, Bioshock, Dishonored, they're all basically creating these emergent systems that you can have these smaller elements within the game that you get to create, but then they're all tied into this embedded storyline that you have to go through to progress through the game. So the fact that your character in Dishonored is honorable or not is within the player's possibility space. They can decide whether or not they want to do that, but ultimately you're playing the game, you're playing through the story that the designer wants you to play. So how do you, when you're making your games, how can you use some of these elements in a really inexpensive, cheap way of doing it? For the story of the world, there's three ways in basically levels of complication and expense. The title of your game, the design of your characters, and the design of your environment, the sounds and visuals that you see as you're playing the game. So, does anybody remember this game? No? Yeah, I do too. Okay, you've got this title, Zombie Ate My Neighbors. What's the game about? What's the story of the game? What else do we know about the story, just through this title and through the cover art?
You're not a zombie.
Okay, you're not a zombie.
Are you trying to escape?
Possibly, yeah.
You probably don't want to be eaten by neighbors, just metaphorically.
Probably, yeah. Also, neighbors kind of...
Mystery,
maybe? Neighbors kind of goes towards this like suburban kind of element, maybe, possibly.
Do you like your neighbors?
Yeah.
No.
Who does like their neighbors,
right?
So it's borrowing from a lot of tropes, like those B-movies, 1950s tropes. There's maybe a suburban element to it. But already, without even playing the game, you have kind of a clue as to what's going on with this game. What is this game really about?
I heard comedic, too, kind of quietly, which is key to the game, right?
Absolutely.
It's not a horror game. By the fact that it has zombies in it, at no point in the game are you like, oh my gosh, I'm scared.
How about this one? An older game. What's it about? Atari 2600.
So the assist died.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like there's a fight going on.
Yeah, yeah. It's the Earth dies screaming. It's the apocalypse, the end of the world.
It looks spacey.
Yeah, there's a little bit of spaciness to it. Maybe it's from some outside alien coming in to destroy the world. It's actually the 20th Century Fox. This is actually a film adaptation. It's not quite a film adaptation. It has nothing to do with the film, but it borrows the title. But yeah, that choice of font here is very specific. I mean, it's gonna the font you choose and the way you present your title is going to help the player understand how to interact with this piece of software, with this game. I mean, in fact, in the 80s, that was even a more important thing than it is today. The feelies that came with games, the manual, the cloth map, which you don't have those things anymore. You aren't giving out a map with your game. You're not giving out a physical copy anymore. So there's other things you need to do within the game to take account of that. But character design, does anybody know this one?
Oh.
Yeah. What's the character? Like, who is he? Okay, it's a harder one. He's Manny Calavera. He's the Grim Reaper. That's the cloak and the scythe. What kind of world is he from? Like, what kind of world is he in? What's that?
He's an aristocrat. He's wearing a suit.
Yeah. He's got some authority. He's got some. Uh, he's He's a major player, and in fact, he's the PC character in the game. Well, what this is doing is it's basically using character design to subvert some tropes and it's referring back to other media and other things. The Grim Reaper is a really common design. The skulls themselves are Day of the Dead style inspired. So he's basically in the afterlife, collecting the souls of the dead, inspired with a little bit of like a Mexican Day of the Dead on Día de los Muertos, inspired imagery. That's his work clothes. In the middle is his casual clothes. He's a manager, so he's got a nice blazer. At the end over here, the tuxedo is it's actually he has a bar that's kind of a riff off of Rick's bar from Casablanca. So that's where that's going. All right, easier one. Who's that? What does he do? What is his frame of? Like, what's going on in this frame right here? Yeah, he's waiting. He's breaking the fourth wall. He's like, come on, what are you doing? Let's run, let's go. This is the idle animation. When you're not using the controller, he's just looking at you, tapping his foot, saying, let's just get out of here. So it's showing a little bit of the story behind Sonic. He's got these his character design is all about speed. Huge shoes, spiky hair, it's flowing fast. But then there's also this impatience. He's standing here not running. He's supposed to run. If you're not running in this game, you're playing this game wrong. If you're trying to collect all the rings, you're playing this game wrong. You just want to get through the level as fast as you can based on how the character design is set up.
Did you wait too long to get
to something?
Does
he? Yeah. Oh, really?
A couple of the games, yeah.
How long?
I think it's like 5 minutes.
That's a long time. I'd do that too. So here's another element, environmental storytelling, really, really big among AAA games a few years back, and this might be one of the games that kind of like brought it to the fore. Does anybody recognize the game here?
Portal.
Yes. Where are we in Portal here?
Yeah.
No, so it's actually, we're still in a testing chamber, but we're behind the scenes of a testing chamber. So what we've got here is a element of the game you might not actually experience when you play the game on your own. Eventually, you're going to go behind the scenes no matter what and continue through that. But this is kind of a hint about midway through the testing chambers, showing you there's something more going on to the world than what's being presented to you. It's not a cutscene. It's not a scripted event. It's two walls and incredibly low-res writing. There's a cheap element that they can easily throw in there based on some previous elements they already had to give better structure of what the game's about. So in this case, it's actually, you can kind of see the photos over there. There's like the stop watching what I'm doing over there. Cake is a lie. Somebody else has escaped before you. Somebody else figured out something going on around there before you. And they've been in here for a really long time. I think those hash marks.
Ah, yes.
They've been in here forever. I mean, maybe they're dead. Maybe you're going to find their body. You don't know. This is one of those elements where it's giving you a really powerful gap in your knowledge. It's exposing a gap in your knowledge. It's saying, here's something, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. And even by the time you get to the end of it, it's not entirely explained ever throughout the game. What actually happened here, but it's a powerful enough gap that makes you think and makes you want to put together the pieces as you play the game. If you play this game for the first time and see this level before you get behind the scenes, you might actually question a lot of what's going on around you as you're playing the game. That's basically what they were trying to get, the kind of experience they were trying to get out of that. So other building blocks we're giving the player, so their experience becomes a narrative experience, and that includes like the premise of the game, the goal of the game, events that happen within the game, and then what we're going to call micro-narratives. So here's the premise.
A futuristic high-tech computer crime game for the hacker elite. You're an uplink agent, a freelance hacker. Your clients, global multinationals. You hack into rival computer systems, steal research data, sabotage other companies, launder money, erase the evidence, even frame innocent people. All for the comfort of your own home. In Uplink, you are the hacker elite. Fund more dangerous or profitable missions. Change people's academic and even criminal records. Then siphon money from their bank account into yours. And why not construct the most deadly computer virus ever designed? But watch out. When you're online, you're being traced. Uplink. The game is corrupt at heart, where trust is a weakness.
Using genre tropes, connecting back to science fiction, to cyberpunk fiction, to the idea of the elusive hacker in a database system, in a network. The game itself has very little story. It's got elements of story that kind of support this narrative. But you're playing the game. You are a hacker. You're actually doing what the hacker does in the game. You're connecting to servers. You're inserting bad code into servers to get them to crash. You're reading other people's emails. You're trying to decrypt and hack passwords. All those verbs, all those elements within the game are exposed in the trailer here. And the trailer gives a really good encapsulation of what the game's about. So when you're thinking of, like, sometimes when you're thinking about your own games, like, what would the trailer for your game look like? Especially if you're kind of stuck in how you're going to implement the story within your game, how you're going to expose some of the story in your game. Maybe just thinking about what that trailer would look like is going to help you figure out what elements you need to make sure that are in your game that have been in your head but not haven't actually reached the game yet. What other examples of really powerful game premises have you seen that just the premise alone like really really showed what the story could be, where the story could go?
You're a kid in a world filled with monsters that have different abilities. For some reason, you're going out to battle. And
why the hell does your mom let you go battle other creatures?
So
does it ever explain it? Do they ever explain why it's cool for kids to subject creatures to their will and battle to the death? Doesn't need to. It's why not? What would you do? But yeah. Actually, the company makes this game has a really good reputation for making these kind of very high level premise games, like DEFCON, a game where it entirely takes place within a game board that kind of looks like war games, where you are creating missile defense systems, and in the end, the world blows up because it always does. Okay, this might be an older reference. I don't know if anybody knows this. Final Fantasy IV. Any players of Final Fantasy IV? What is Rydia the Summoner? Who is she? Do you remember?
Well, I mean, you first find her, you destroy her village or whatever.
Yeah.
And then she comes back later.
Yeah. So she's somebody you're adding to your party. Early on, her village is destroyed by fire. She hates fire. Fyra is a really basic spell that most black mages within the Final Fantasy universe have. It's one of the first ones they usually get. Either fire or ice or water, one of those elemental spells. But she can't get fire. And in fact, it's not till later on at a scripted game element happens that fire becomes part of her spell list, and you can finally get to use this fire spell elsewhere. So basically staggering and introducing mechanics within the game attached to story elements are really powerful. Fire is actually a really powerful thing now that you finally have it. When you don't have it, you can't go into some of the ice areas. You can't. It's some areas are actually hidden from you within the game, and it requires the story element to actually happen. In this case, it's happening through a cutscene, but it can happen through many other ways. But Metroid does this without often exposing the story as well as this does, where you've got elements within your game that are locked behind doors. You need a key. All fire here is a key. But the fact that fire is also usable outside of that one little experience of the key, it's actually usable throughout the game once you have it, makes it much more powerful and much more needed. And can really help helps with the story of this game. Okay, even older here, and we're talking about micro-narratives. This is a game called Jet Set Willy. It's from 1982-ish. It's a sequel to a previous game called Manic Miner. In Manic Miner, you're Willy. You're mining, and you get lots and lots of gold, and then you have a party, and you destroy your house. You wreck your house. At the beginning of the game, your landlord here, your landlady here, you just want to go to bed. She's in your room telling, no, go clean the house. She's got one action that she does, one small little animation with, what is that, 32 by 32, if that, maybe 16 by 16 little pixels. That's just this. That's the story in the in Jet Set Willy, is this entire action. No, you don't get to go to bed. Go clean your room. Go clean the house. Fix my house before you get to rest. Okay. So this next section, we'll talk about story on a budget. Basically, what are some of the things that you can do and some other examples we can do. Basically, to reuse assets and features and to better use global features that you have for the entire game to expose some of the story elements of the game. I know I told a lot of people about this game. Did anybody play Dark Room? Okay. So Dark Room is great for this. It uses lots of scripted events, and it's really basic. It's just text. This is the first, I think, three or four actions in the game where it's kind of helping you understand what the mechanic of the game is. The mechanic of this game is click a button, wait for a meter to build, click the button again. That's about it. Later on, you get to choose which buttons you want to click. There's a system of supply and economics going on, and an ecological system later on. Really more of a supply and demand system. But anyway, it's more complicated later on. But in the beginning, click. The room is cold. Fire's dead. Click. Fire's burning. Click. The light from the fire spills from the windows out into the dark. The fire is roaring. Click. The room is mild. Okay, whatever. Click. A ragged stranger stumbles through the door and collapses in the corner. But you don't really get to interact with that person. All you get to do is stoke that fire. You stoke it again a few more times, and then it slowly opens up some things. And in this case, what got opened was you've got wood, and now then you've got a forest that you can go to. So it's basically exposing, it's connecting new elements within the mechanics. As each time you open up a new mechanic, something interesting happens, and you're filling in these gaps. Like, who is this stranger? What is this world? Why am I sticking this fire? And what is out there? And what's beyond? And it's really using mystery to bring you through that. Another example. This is from a game created at the Game Lab back in 08. In this game, you are a girl who's trying to chew gum in this land where gum chewing is banned. There are guards, some Metal Gear Solid style guards, who are walking around, and if they see you chewing gum, they will beat you up. If you chew gum next to one of these other little girls, they'll also chew gum and join you and join this little march. So as you progress, you get more followers. You need to collect all the followers to get through the end of the game, but you're more visible to the guards. What started as a bug in the game was when you're chewing the gum, you can pop the gum on a person. You can pop the gum on a guard to kind of like get them stalled. But guards are looking for people with gum, and in the way they created the game, they saw a guard who was covered in gum. He counted as an object with gum, so he got beaten up. It's a bug that turned into a feature and became this really, really nice emergent event where it's a strategy to play the game is to pop gum on guards so other guards beat them up and you don't get beaten up. What's that?
Was this made with people from Singapore?
Yes. Yeah.
Thinly veiled protest. There being one country on the planet where gum is illegal.
It depends on what you can do with Singapore. What are you talking about? Absolutely
not. Remember, your objects that you use in the game, all the elements within your game, can have stories connected to them. These are four examples of games created at the Game Lab. The one issue here is the budget for this can be cheap, it can be expensive, and the budget you're talking about, and this is your art budget. And both of these situations, these are some of the least expensive ones, versions that we have, where on the right side, you have someone creating, an artist creating a really well-detailed room. It's a hidden object game. The objects themselves are going to help tell the story of, and this is the example that Richard gave last week, was a game that he worked on, where the sound and the music were helping you understand the story and helping you connect the puzzles in the game. But art asset-wise, it's just that one picture. It's a really well-detailed picture, and then a list of words, but that's it. On the left here, stranded in Singapore, the objects within the game, it's a point-and-click adventure game where you are collecting things in Singapore, combining things together, and then giving them to people to kind of solve quests. Largely food-oriented, because that's what Singapore is really good about, is food. But the fact that you're in this, marketplace with these multiple ethnicity styles of food, the chicken rice kebab, laksa, the Indian food. And you've got these different characters within the interface. There's the gap there is that why are these characters within this scene? Why do they want this object? The game isn't telling you why. The game is actually randomizing it. The game doesn't care that the carbon gooby man, the garbage collector there, wants to he will give you like a what is it? At some point he might give you like a popsicle stick or a bag of coffee because coffee comes in bags sometimes. In exchange for a bag of garbage. Doesn't matter. The story of the game, though, is that you are interacting with these interesting people to get out of Singapore. You're stranded. I mean, you're trying to catch your flight, but the hotelier is basically, well, why just stay in your house all stay in the apartment all day? I'm going to kick you out. Go explore Singapore and bring me this. Find this thing for me. So just by going out and exploring Singapore, exploring all these different objects, putting together and bringing them back to her, it's a really basic story. But it's enough that it gets the player to actually use the mechanics that they're being presented. Another thing you have at your hand are genre and tropes. This is another Game Lab game called Snowfield, or it's an experiment in a narrative design using emergent mechanics and little to no AI. This is much closer to that Minecraft style of world building, but with a little bit of change in the element. There's some intent to these objects. You're this soldier here and here. And you come across this dead soldier with a letter on the ground. Later on, there's another soldier that you can interact with. If you get near him, he says something to you in a language you don't understand. I think it turns out to be French or German. And really what he's saying is he wants the letter. If you have the letter in your inventory and you give him the letter, he'll follow you and go to the house with the fire. There's really not much else to the game, but the objects within the game, they're different, right? Like they're brighter. You can see them better on the battlefield. You know you want to collect them. You know other people might want them. You know people are asking for something because they're looking at you, pleading with you for something, but you don't know what they want. It's basically borrowing genre tropes from war fiction and then subverting them a little bit. A letter that you can't read, alcohol that you can't drink. At one point, there's a rifle that can't be actually used. So it's making some commentaries on war and commentaries on the battlefield by really trying to use those gaps, that information you just don't have on hand. And that, when put in the proper context, when the player uses it, hopefully the player understands what's going on. I think this is the last specific mechanical example. This is a closed world. It's an RPG, and in an RPG, you spend a lot of time with your battle system. It's the thing you do the most. So what they did in this game was make sure that battle system was part of the greater narrative of the game. And in a closed world, basically, you're ostracized from your family and from your community because of who you happen to love. So you're fighting your inner demons. It's a lot of metaphor going on here. So you're fighting your inner demons, and your inner demons might represent your siblings, your relationship with your brother, your relationship with your father and mother, and you're using the powers of Aristotle. Logos, pathos, and ethos to basically persuade them towards what you believe and what you're thinking. And really, you're not being presented with the parent themselves. It's with your interior idea of what that parent represents. You're just trying to get through and better understand yourself, so that by the time you get through the game, you might have some kind of revelation. So each demon has their own weaknesses and attack styles that kind of hint toward the story. Some of them respond to logic a little bit more than passion or ethics. So there's a little bit of strategy going on there. But all of this ties back into that greater story element. It's not just that you are fighting, and we use the word fight, because that's basically all this is. It's fight, magic, jump, whatever. It doesn't matter what they are. You label them in a different way. It puts them in a different context. And all of a sudden, the player is connecting to the story in a different way. So what do we gain from bringing story into our games? We understand our experience of stories, so stories will help your players understand the game. It can explain the world and encourage the player to explore it more, to know it more, and also provide some consistency to the world. to be sure, and so you have to be sure that you actually do have a consistent view of your world when you're looking at the mechanics in your game. Story is one of those elements that can connect all those mechanics together if done right. If done poorly, it can break it all, and the player just doesn't know what the hell to do in the game at all. So even if you don't want story in your game, you might end up with story in your game just because you're trying to explain to your player, this is how this mechanic works in the situation that you're in. So I've got some anecdotes that we're going to give about problem solving, but you also had a little tidbit here.
One of the things that you're going to see a lot of, there's a couple different ways to approach story in games. We talked about game with some gameplay and then a cutscene, and gameplay and a cutscene. And Final Fantasy is really famous for that. And we talked about an example. You just talked about an example where in the early Final Fantasies, one of your characters was afraid of fire and therefore wouldn't use fire. And that's about as connected as Final Fantasy combat to get to their story. For the most part, when you go into Final Fantasy combat, you're in an entirely different world. Right? And one of the things that I consider, there's nothing really particularly wrong with this kind of storytelling, but it's skipping an advantage that you might have by tying things together a little bit more closely. So in Final Fantasy, very frequently, you'll go into combat mode, and all of a sudden, you have godlike power, right? You can call the moon down from the heavens to crash into the earth and cause a huge explosion. But you end the combat, and you're thwarted by a picket fence. Right? Why don't you call down the moon to destroy the picket fence? And so the thing that I like to think about is, your verb set from your gameplay in Final Fantasy is, you know, you're throwing around fast cosmic power, or all of a sudden you flip a coin and your verb set is walk around and open chests, right? It's very possible to, in your game, try to merge these two things. And when you do that, you're reinforcing each other in a strong way. So for example, and this is an extreme example, if you look at Tetris, never ever in Tetris do you think to yourself, why can't I jump? It never happens. Whereas in Final Fantasy you can think, well, I should be able to destroy that fence or that forest. Or why can't I push through the trees? I mean, I have a sword that cuts through anything. Why can't I chop down trees? All these questions come up. In Tetris, they never do. If you think about some of the Endless Runner games, I don't know if how many of you played Cannonball that Flixel was done for, right? Cannonball actually works really, really well in a very, very subtle way with its storytelling. You don't know why you can't run left. It's never explained. But this guy is running, and there's an Armageddon happening behind him. There's giant robots. There's things falling from the sky. And quickly you realize, well, maybe he's running from something and doesn't want to go left. Right? So you don't ask that question too much. There was at least one Endless Runner that you guys did this year where your water was flowing downhill. You never ask, why can't the water flow uphill? Because water doesn't flow uphill, right? And that is a really good story plus game mechanic fitting together really, really nicely. And it's cheap, right? In those two games, it's extremely cheap. If you look at a game, a lot of the roguelike games also do fairly well at this, but then they have a huge verb set. But in a lot of the roguelike games, you're not asking yourself, you know, why can't I drive a car? Well, there's no car. I mean, anything I can think of, I can mostly do. But one of the tricks that you want to do is, if you can have a story, let's say there's a game mechanic that you aren't allowing the player. If you have a story reason for that, the player will accept it a lot more readily. Or similarly, if there's a story element that you want to disallow, or a story path that doesn't make any sense, you can also try to treat that with your game mechanics. Like my character can fight with a sword, but doesn't have any ranged weapons. Okay, then it's not so surprising that I can't use a grappling hook to get somewhere or whatever because I don't have anything ranged. Like you can tie these things all together like that. I don't have a lot more to say about that. So modern sandbox games are actually getting better and better about this. If you look at, you know, Grand Theft Auto and those kinds of games, the verb set and the gameplay set in story and gameplay are mostly the same. They break apart when they start getting into the cutscenes. In a lot of games, you know, in the cutscene, your character might be vaulting off of buildings and stuff, and if you try to do that in the real game, you die or you can't jump. But for the most part, a lot of games are trying to go this route these days. But when you're talking about your low-budget, smaller game, you can really find good ways to tie them all together. I don't have a lot more to say right this instant about that.
Cool. Thanks. So lastly, some anecdotes from us about problems that we had in game development that we solved through story. So in my case, I worked on a game called Elude. It was a game about depression, which had this metaphorical aspect where if you are high in the tree, so you'd climb, you'd jump. It's kind of like what if Doodle Jump, instead of being this constrained, only going up all the way, you can't scroll left or right. What if it were an actual just full platformer? Where if you're reaching higher ground, going up to the trees,
you are escaping your depression. If you're at the bottom of the trees, these tendrils will come up and grab you and pull you down, and that's pulling you into depression. So high is good, low is bad. And you had a couple things you can use to power yourself up. Basically, you had this hum mechanic where if you created a musical note that resonated with the world, and the world gave you energy and made you jump a little bit higher. But players really didn't understand what that was, how that worked, why it worked the way it did, what the hell did it have to do with the depression, any of that stuff. So we slowly introduced little story elements with tons of narrative gap. Who knows why things are the way they were, but they are, and they're consistent throughout the world, so players just accepted it. In this case, we first added, we always had birds, so the birds are the things you'd sing to, and the birds would give you these little dots, and the dots would make you glow, and then if you were able to glow, you could jump. Okay, fine. I'm singing to birds now? Why? So then we added these statue elements with a little bit of musical iconography. So all these elements had like either a flute or a lyre or some kind of old-style musical instrument. And we tried a bunch of different things. We actually tried phonographs and tape recorders and things like that. And it just didn't, like, why am I in this jungle, this forest, with some weird used music equipment over? But why am I in this jungle with these statues? Well, there's some fantastical element to this. And the player's like, okay, I can understand that. I've done this before. And by placing the birds on there, and early on, you get the hum ability. It just writes it in the background. It says press space to resonate. But then also, what does it have to do to depression? We started adding these little quotes. And we put these little like quote elements. We use text a lot in the game to kind of just create this coherent experience that we're sending you a message. The text is there to tell you something. The text might be there to help you play the game, but really it's there to provide just yet another piece of atmosphere, yet another thing to connect with the game. None of this actually created a narrative. There's no story to the game. There's nothing we're actually trying to tell you other than the fact that depression is something that is something you could strive against. It's something that is hard to strive against. It's something that you might try to do alone or with other people, but at the end, depression is going to pull you down. Depression is something that's going to, it's this thing that might feel external, but it's actually internal. And it's kind of it's not like you can't do anything about it. It's something that you have very little agency over. And when the depression happens, you can't move as much anymore. You can't really, you can't jump as high. And we're just trying to get that message across that if you know a friend who has depression and they're being an asshole or they're just sad, guess what? It sucks. It's probably not their fault. And maybe you want to talk to them about it. Maybe you just want to let them be what they are. It doesn't really matter. And that all those aspects of it would actually be done through with a clinician in this game's case. So the game isn't trying to tell you that much. The game is really just trying to tell you that, yeah, this condition kind of sucks, doesn't it? So that's how we use narrative in that game. And Sarah's got two games to talk about.
Okay. So these are actually two games that I worked on with teams over the summer. So we had about 8 weeks, and we had about 8 people on each of these games. With Waker, we actually had, as part of the game design, we had to have a good story that supported the gameplay. And it had to be an educational game on physics. We started out, and since we knew story was important from the beginning, we came up with our sort of, here's our story, here's our aesthetic, and then we moved over to getting the gameplay working. About 2 weeks from ship, we realized, wait a minute, we've got a plan for our story, but we haven't actually implemented the story, and we went back to take a look at how we were going to implement the story. It was going to involve lots of long, complicated cutscenes that our artists did not have time to create, and that no one on the team actually had the writing skill to write. So this was one of the we had two big requirements on this. Educational game that taught physics, check. Story that interleaved with the game, uncheck. And so we had to figure out how do we solve that problem relatively quickly. What we ended up doing was that we were too late to really interleave the story into the game very better than we have with the artisan, with the narrative background. What we ended up doing was finding someone who could write who was not on the team, begging, and having him write a bunch of cutscenes that were primarily audio, so they were narrated, with a very simple background using wallpapers we'd already created and images that we lifted straight off the storyboards from the large, fantastical cutscenes that were never going to happen. And then we had this, the short text, and pretty much everything up there, that's what you saw during the cutscene while it read to you. And that became our story. And we had about five of these because there were five places where we already had code written for cutscenes to be inserted. And so we said, okay, this story has to fit in this number of cutscenes, not fewer, not more, because this is where we can put them. And so we managed to actually pull together a bit of a story using actually the resources we still had left. Our artists, we really slammed at that point. Our program, we had a little bit of programming, we had a whole lot of audio. And so our audio designer was able to put a lot of work into making sure that it came out sounding really good. Waker actually ended up winning a couple of awards for its story at independent game festivals. And I think one of the reasons it did that was because we knew the narrative and the story. We had the story in our heads at the beginning, even if we didn't actually have it written down. And so all of the aesthetic in both the game and the little tacked on cutscenes at the end all matches together really well. Because we sort of knew what area we were in, we just never got around to actually getting down to the details.
Another thing to really think about there is that restrictions are awesome, right? Stories are really, really hard to write if you're told to write a story.
Mm-hmm.
But if suddenly you're told, write a story, you have five parts, you have to get across these ideas, you have only text, and very little of it, and it's got to have something to do with solving these puzzles, right? That's actually, strangely, a much easier task than writing a story. If any of you have taken writing classes, you'll probably resonate with that a little bit. If you write a story about a dog and a hammer, it's easier than write a story.
Yeah. We also already had sort of the main topic. We knew that the game was about someone who was dreaming, and we knew that the game was about rescuing that dreamer from their dreams. So we already had, you know, the setting and the core. We just didn't have the story. Anyways, that was that one. Another... These are, by the way, narratives gone wrong. This is the narratives gone wrong portion of the speech. I don't know. So another game I worked on, which was Exa, and we didn't, story was not a strong requirement for this game, and that's where we made our really big mistake, I think. What we had to have was have a Facebook game that had some sort of puzzly interplay. And in the beginning, we sat down and we brainstormed our story, and we brainstormed our game mechanics mostly side by side. And we ended up with any number of ideas from aliens, mutants, anamorphic characters, lost civilizations. I think the only trope we didn't actually discover and write a storyboard for were zombies and pirates. After we had gone through this big pile of, frankly, really rehashed and overused tropes, we set aside, so we'll just concentrate on the game for a while. We'll get back to the narrative, because maybe once we get the solid game, it'll suggest a story to us. Well, somewhere around week 6 or week 7, we still don't have a story, and our artists want to start making UI pieces. And the UI, we're going to be telling all of our stories, we're going to be telling it through the UI, because this is a Facebook game. There aren't cutscenes. There aren't big discussions. There aren't dialogues. There's just little UI screens that help you through or tutorial you through the game and show you what you're doing, which meant that for the UI and the tutorial to be written, we had to have a story or at least a solid background, and we really didn't have any. What we ended up doing was calling an emergency committee where we had three people. We sat down and said, okay, out of all of the hokey ideas that we came up with, which one fits in quickest and fastest with what we've got? And it ended up being sort of the hidden civilization concept. And we kind of forced the team to go with that. It didn't end up working out as well. It mostly works, but it didn't really work out as well. But we got it. We made a decision and went with it, and bowled forward. If we'd made that decision, that same exact decision with the same amount of arbitrariness 3 weeks earlier, the game would have been much better, because all of the little gameplay and twiddles and mechanics that we shifted around and we made along the way as we were making the game would have been referenced back to that narrative decision. Instead, we were just sort of flailing around and making, well, what do you think will happen? I don't know. What do you think should happen? So the take-home from that is, that I would take from that is, if you don't have a good idea for your story and you've got several things to choose from, choose something and go with it. All right.
That's actually a pretty common trick when you're looking at a short schedule. Even if it's a technical decision, you don't have enough information to make it. Make it anyway. Stick with that until you find out that you can't.
Yeah.
So you might actually save some effort over leaving it open and trying to keep wrestling with the issue. It turns out that sometimes just a decision is more important than making the right decision.
Yeah.
Because you don't need to make a 100% perfect decision. You need to make a 90% good enough decision on most of the things you're trying to solve. And it's counter to a lot of people, especially programmers, to do that. Trust me, I know. You don't want to make a 90% probably good enough decision. But you can't optimize everything all the time. Or you could spend 2 weeks trying to make a decision, which you just don't have.
Okay. So my example, that's not what I wanted to show. That's what I wanted to show. Okay, let me see what I got the sound looking. How many people have played A Slow Speed of Light? Okay, a couple of hands. So you kind of know what this game's about, but for the people who haven't, I just got to tweak something, one more thing on my screen because I don't have it mirrored right now, and that makes it difficult for me to do demo this game. It's a physics simulation. It's a game about relativity, about traveling near the speed of light, about relativity, special relativity, for anyone who's actually taken those classes at MIT. And because of that, we knew that we wanted to create physics code that could later be reused for experiments. We couldn't play very fast and very loose with physics in the way how a lot of games do. For instance, you know, you play a game like Call of Duty or something, a first-person game. Our game's also a first-person game. When you look around the world, you move your mouse, and the camera moves around. You use WASD, you move forward, back, left, and right. Typically, when you go in a first-person shooter, the moment you hit W, you take off at full speed. Maybe there's a sprint button that makes you go even faster, but if you wanted to, you could go from a standing stop to full speed right away. And when you want to stop, you also stop on a dime. Anyone who's actually taken a kinematics class here in MIT realizes that's not how, you know, physics works. There's inertia, there's, you know, friction, there's momentum, and all of these things that you have to take into account. And if trying to basically fudge too much with physics will make it will compromise a lot of the principles of the project. Another thing that you might also know about traveling near the speed of light is that when you get closer to the speed of light, it becomes much more difficult for you to change your momentum. You can slow down in about the same amount as effort, but when you try to go a little bit closer to the speed of light, it takes vastly amount larger amount of energy. It feels like you're actually getting heavier and heavier. So we wanted to be able to get all of these senses, all of these concepts over. And what you end up with is a game that actually feels a little bit less like walking around and a little bit more like driving. You know, you're kind of like, so I'm just like tapping the key. If I hit W, I sort of accelerate a little bit. But then you kind of glide to a stop. And what happens is that you end up driving your character around and doing these kinds of like little power slides. You know, it's almost like a drift racing game. And in fact, one of the original ideas of this game was, in fact, a driving game, because the physics actually matches driving games a lot closer than, you know, first-person walking around and shooting things game. You don't shoot anything in this game, you just walk around. So, I can go in a little bit more into relativistic effects, but that's the first thing that you do in this game as a player, once you're past the menus, is you move forward, and if you've played any number of PC first-person games, you go like, whoa, you know, it's like, am I skating? Am I on ice? But the physics model kind of demanded that we had to do that. So, since this is about problem solving, what we did was we decided to address this problem through all of the story elements in this game. How do we sell the idea that this is okay? So just right from the opening screen, we already have, you know, this kind of peculiar character. You know, like, who are you in this world, in this space? You are there? You're a ghost? I heard ghost. This is how the story starts. Once upon a time in a quiet village, there was a little child. And the child dies. So yes, you are a little ghost. You begin the journey to become one with light, but the kid is too clumsy and can't go that fast because it's a little kid. So that's the whole idea, right? It's like, why don't you have any friction? Because you're a ghost. Why do I keep walking to walls all the time? Because you're a little kid ghost. and then there's this bit which we like kind of shoehorn in, which is luckily the spirit world is full of these things that slow down light for you. And then everything else is just straightforward UI instruction. In fact, you can see we actually changed the colors at one point because we wanted to get people to, all right, story time's over, instruction menu now. And that was basically it. But the sound effects, the shape of the world, even the fact that in the loading screen you kind of like do a little hover, we wanted that to be a lot smoother, but loading screens are hard. The fact that the world is set at night, there's physical reasons for that as well as story reasons. Nighttime is good for ghosts, but nighttime is also good for not casting too many shadows, which won't suck if you're changing the speed of light. So that's basically how we applied these ideas to games. And of course, once we had that story in place, that changed the way how we did certain things during gameplay. Right at the end of the game, you see this like big white arch appear in the middle. Where it's a much larger version of what you already see here. These arches, and the whole idea is that you pass through the pearly gates and then you move on to the afterlife or something like that. That was how we decided to end the game, because like at the time when we were building this game, we had no idea what completion meant. I guess you could just pick up 100 of these orbs and be done with it. And a lot of people do, in fact, end there. But there's a kind of a narrative conclusion. You can pick up 100 orbs and find that gate at the end. It's hard to miss because it's the biggest thing in the world. That's basically it. That's
how I applied.
Yeah.
So those are basically... hopefully, I know you've got where I saw those three of your games being made is got one that may or may not have a story, one that's kind of story driven but not really the RPG, and then one that's very very story driven, right? So each of your games are going to have different ways of using story. In the story driven game, the story might actually be the problem that you're trying to solve. With the game that doesn't require a lot of story, the story actually might be the thing that's trying to help you illustrate to the user what the mechanics are within the game. Do you have any questions about any of this, or any specific questions about your games and how you can use story in your games? Okay. So that's the end for lecture. Go ahead, take a break, and then break into your teams.
Content from the following sources is copyright of the respective holders. All rights reserved. Excluded from our Creative Commons license. For more information, see ocw.mit.edu/fairuse. Ivy Software. Uplink Trailer. February 3rd, 2011. YouTube Video. A Slower Speed of Light. MIT Game Lab. 2013. Video Game.